Chapter 8. The Ranger. It was an interlude, a tragicomic interruption which few in Texas sought, but which most later accepted as a turning point in their history. At a time when the newly approved state should have been paying attention to the building of governmental process and the sorting out of priorities, it found itself enmeshed in the Mexican War of 1846 to 1848, a minor affair militarily, a major event diplomatically. Internally, the effect on Texas was minimal. Two battles and a disastrous cavalry encounter were fought on its soil, and its men invaded a foreign country where they gained attention because of their bravery and lack of discipline. More important, men from the other 28 states, Iowa becoming the 29th in 1846, served in Texas and set home harrowing stories of bleak, empty spaces, drought, Mexicans, and rattlesnakes. Of maximum importance, national newspapers sent to the war reporters, sketchers, and a remarkable man named Harry Saxon, who brought with him an unprecedented amount of gear to report upon Texas and the war. Their stories and pictures circulated around the world to launch the legend of Texas. The American Army was not in Texas by accident, nor was it there in response to any specific threat by the Mexican government. Instead, there had been a gradual worsening of relations between the two countries and some curious actions on the part of each. President-elect Polk, having been a prime force in bringing Texas into the Union, was determined to add New Mexico and Upper California so as to round out the continental reach of the United States. And since Mexico was either uninterested in developing these areas or incapable of doing so, he supposed that the Mexicans might be willing to sell them for a decent price in order to be shed of responsibility. He was aware, of course, that the sudden acquisition of so much new land would force the American government to decide once and for all whether the resulting new states should be slave or free, and that would ignite dormant antipathies between South and North. But on that thorny question, he was willing to postpone decision. Even before Polk had been inaugurated in 1845, the kettle of war was bubbling. The United States Congress authorized annexation. Mexico, feeling insulted, terminated diplomatic relations, and the new president initiated a pair of daring moves. First, he ordered a sizable army unit to Corpus Christi on the northern border of the Nueces Strip, and warned its commander to be prepared to strike if events required. Next, he dispatched a personal emissary, John Slidell, to Mexico, with an offer to buy New Mexico for $5 million, California for $25 million, and to pay up to $40 million for a more complete package. When the Mexicans rebuffed Slidell for having offended their national honor, Polk saw that the two nations were on what he believed to be an unavoidable collision course. Forthwith, he began to prepare for the war which he knew and even hoped must come. In command of the eager troops at Corpus Christi was a crusty general known for his courage, his stubbornness, and his lack of education, who had been sent into Texas with orders to protect the American frontier, but not to invade Mexico unless hostile action made this inescapable. Zachary Taylor was an almost perfect choice for the job. His frontier manner made him congenial to the Texans, and his dogged, no-frills approach to battle made him an effective opponent to the flamboyant Mexicans. He did, however, face a difficult diplomatic problem. Where was the Texas frontier he was supposed to protect? When France controlled the Mississippi, Spain had been agitated over the border between Spanish Texas and French Louisiana. And after Mexico won her independence, she too kept careful watch along that border. But neither Spain nor Mexico cared much what the border between Texas and its neighboring districts to the south was. It was assumed that this inconsequential delineation ran along the Medina and Nueces rivers. So when Texas broke away in 1836, officials in Mexico honestly believed that these rivers still marked the boundary between New Texas and Old Coahuila and Tamaulipas, and that the infamous Nueces Strip was Mexican. But the nation of Texas, and now the United States, had always argued that the boundary lay south at the Rio Grande, but neither had much reliable documentation to prove this. Now, in 1845, The Nueces Strip was as much an area of contention as it had always been. The site of the troop concentration had not been chosen at random. The village of Corpus Christi, with its 200 citizens, lay where the Nueces River entered the Gulf of Mexico, and this put it at the northeastern edge of the Nueces Strip. From here, the army would stand in readiness for a leap into Mexico proper whenever events warranted. The soldiers at Corpus came from all parts of the Union and represented the emerging mix of national origins. 24% Scots-Irish, 10% German, 6% English, 3% Scots direct, 4% other foreign-born, and 53% native-born, nicely balanced between infantry, cavalry, and artillery, with emphasis on the latter. When President Polk learned that John Slidell's offer to buy most of northern Mexico had been rejected, he judged that relations between the two countries had deteriorated so noticeably that he had better move General Taylor and his army closer to Mexico. So in late March 1846, Taylor leapfrogged clear across the Nueces Strip and assumed a position near the mouth of the Rio Grande. He did this knowing that such an invasion of territory claimed by Mexico must provoke reaction, and he was prepared for war, as was President Polk in Washington. If the truth were known, both the general and the president hoped for war. Old rough-and-ready Taylor may have been as slow-witted as his junior officers sometimes thought, and the depths of his ignorance and fumbling were widely known. But when an enemy took a defined position on terrain that had been scouted, Taylor, 62 years old and wheezing, knew what to do. The first order he had issued upon leaving Corpus Christi endeared him to his subordinates. "When we have marched 3 miles into the desert, I want every camp follower who has attached herself or himself to my army kicked the hell out. If they won't go back to Corpus on their own, put them in irons and march them off with bayonets at their backsides." And in one grand sweep, the hundreds of prostitutes, pimps, gamblers, whiskey peddlers, thieves, and petty traders were booted out. Among these disreputables was a large, pompous gentleman who had been making a small fortune by selling a fantastic variety of things to Taylor's army: whiskey, tobacco, socks, hard candy, cigars, big hats to replace the inadequate type provided by the commissary, and, some said, the favors of Mexican girls who seemed always to be available wherever he located. As soon as the order went out to rid the army of such trash, a rigidly proper West Pointer from South Carolina, Lieutenant Colonel Persifer Cobb, took it upon himself to arrest this man, whose operations he had monitored and whose behavior he deplored. But once he had the unsavory fellow corralled, Cobb found himself involved in a political scandal. "I am a state senator of Texas," the prisoner bellowed, "and a general in the militia." When Cobb questioned other prisoners, they confirmed the claims. "He's Senator Yancey Quimper, hero of San Jacinto, and you're in trouble, Colonel, because he has connections." "Damn Texas," Cobb muttered under his breath. "Where else would you find a general running a whorehouse?" But when Quimper kept demanding that he be taken to General Taylor and threatening to have Cobb cashiered from the army because of my powerful associations in Washington, Cobb had to protect himself, and shortly Yancey Quimper was standing before General Taylor. "Are you indeed a senator?" Taylor asked. And when Quimper replied, "In charge of military affairs," Taylor asked, "And what in hell were you doing among the rabble of my army?" And the senator explained, "Looking after my land interests here." This lie was so offensive to Cobb that without having been invited to speak, he blurted out, "He was running a cheap store, a liquor bar, and worse." At which Quimper drew himself to attention. "I was a general in the Texas Army, and I demand an apology." For one sickening moment, Persifer Cobb feared that General Quimper intended joining the Texan volunteers, and his face drained of blood. But General Taylor, a rough old customer who could at times be magnificent, said, "Get the hell out of here. I suspect you're a fraud." And Senator General Yancey Quimper retreated, muttering threats he knew he could not fulfill. South of the Rio Grande, there was a Mexican who had spent a dozen years also longing for such a war, but who now, when it was about to erupt, had ambivalent feelings arising from an event he could never have anticipated. Benito Garza, aged 40, had fallen in love. When it became apparent that Mexico, in protection of its honor, must oppose any Yankee intrusion into the Nueces Strip, irrevocably the territory of Mexico, Garza had ridden north to assist General Mariano Arista in his defense of Mexican integrity. He was now serving Arista as a superior scout, well informed about the area under contention, and in this capacity he was willing to lay down his life. However, when he moved with Arista to Matamoros, where the Rio Grande enters the Gulf, he found attached to the command a purveyor of salted beef, one José López, who had an attractive daughter bearing a name highly favored by Spanish mothers of a religious bent, María de la Luz, Blessed Mary of the Holy Lights, which children traditionally abbreviated to Lucha. Lucha López was 19 when Garza met her, a tall, slim young woman of curious beauty and dominant will. Her beauty was unusual, in that her features were by no means perfect or strikingly regular. Rather, they were strong, powerfully molded, with high cheekbones indicating a pronounced Indian origin. Her hair, which she wore in a long braid, was jet black, which accentuated her black and piercing eyes. When Garza first saw her delivering a basket lunch to her father, who had been negotiating with General Arista over the price of beef, he noticed that her dark eyes carried a clear sense of sadness, and he asked her father, "Why is your daughter so mournful?" And he replied, "The man she was to marry was killed on the other side of the river, where he kept his cattle." "Who killed him?" Benito asked, and the meat dealer said, "Tejas Rinches." He pronounced the hated word in the manner common along the river, Rinches. "When he was on his own soil?" "Next, they'll be shooting us in Matamoros." In his long years in the saddle, Benito had seen many attractive girls and had idly courted some of them, but his manner of life had prevented him from seriously contemplating marriage. At first, when he met this impressive young woman, he shied away, because he knew that wars and incursions and revolutions would deter him from being a good husband, or even a reasonable one. But Lucha López was not an easy woman to dismiss, and during a 6-week interval before open warfare began, he courted her, at first tentatively, then with growing ardor. Once, as he left her reluctantly, he thought, "She weaves a web about me as a spider traps a fly, and I like being trapped." Their cautious relationship did not follow customary patterns, for on those occasions when they managed to escape her duenna, they often discussed military matters. "Is it true," she asked one afternoon, "that General Taylor has 10,000 troops?" "I've been north twice to see, and I doubt he has 10,000, but many, many." "Then war is inevitable?" "Surely." "Will it involve Matamoros?" "I don't see how you can escape." "Can we win?" Since Benito had been pondering this difficult question for some months, he should have been able to respond quickly, but he did not. Very carefully, he said, "If we had not driven Santa Anna into exile, if he were here instead of languishing in Cuba, we'd have a splendid chance of recapturing Tejas." "Is Santa Anna so good a general?" "He's wonderful at collecting a rabble of men and forging them into a grand army. If only we had him now." "Father thinks highly of General Arista." "And so do I. He'll give a good account of himself." His voice trailed off. "But he's no Santa Anna?" "In all the world there's only one Santa Anna, and he wastes away in Cuba." "You will fight the Norteamericanos?" "Until I die." She kissed him fervently. "Benito, I feel the same way. The Colossus of the North, someone called them the other day. They press down upon us. We can never live with them, never." "How did your man die?" They came upon him, gathering his cattle. He had taken them across the river in April, as always, and they hanged him in July. No questions, no charges. He was Mexicano, and that was enough to hang him. The hatred in her voice echoed Garza's own, and in this mutual rage against an oppressor, their love deepened. But still Benito shied away from any commitment, when, to his astonishment, Lucha said, "In this great battle, it will last our lifetimes, Benito. I want to share it with you. Marriage, home, a garden in peace, will not know them. Their concerns for people like my mother." He placed his fingers across her lips. "It would have to be marriage, Lucha. I've seen how the Norte Americanos ridicule us because of some of our women, the soldaderas they don't marry. With a respectable woman like you, it must be marriage." "I am not a respectable woman," Lucha said harshly. "I'm a woman of the New Mexico, the Mexico that's going to be free." "And I'm a man of the New Mexico, too, the Mexico that's going to demand respect among nations. We marry, or we part now." Lucha's parents, prominent citizens of Matamoros, with their own good home and land in the country, on which Lopez had raised most of the cattle whose meat he sold, strongly opposed the match. For as Lopez pointed out, "He's 40 years old. He could be your father." And as Senora Lopez warned, "He's a bandit. A good one, I'll admit, and on our side, but a roving bandit nevertheless. What kind of home life could you expect?" "What kind of home life will you expect if the Rinches keep coming over the Rio Grande?" she asked. When her parents realized that she was stubbornly prepared to accompany Garza, married or not, they were appalled. And now they became strong advocates of immediate marriage, though not necessarily with Garza. "A girl as pretty as you, you could have any man you wanted. How about that major on General Arista's staff? He keeps making eyes at you." "Aren't a major and a bandit pretty much alike?" "That I wouldn't know," Senora Lopez granted. "But this I do know. A soldadera who follows the troops is no better than a puta." The impasse among the four troubled Mexicans was resolved in a bizarre way. Within the body of patriotic Mexicans, prepared to make extreme sacrifices for their country, was a renegade priest born in Spain, who was known only as Padre Jesus. For some years, in moral desperation and with incredible courage, he had fought for Mexican freedom. A gaunt, determined man, a natural-born ascetic who wore clerical garb and who opposed corruption and injustice wherever he found them, in the church, in politics, in the army, or in the general society. Padre Jesus no longer bothered to report his comings and goings to his conservative religious superiors. And now, with the threat of war menacing the northern boundaries of his adopted nation, he had come without authorization to the Rio Grande to do what he could to help, and the troops had a deep affection for his efforts. When Padre Jesus heard of the conflicts within the Lopez family, he proposed a simple solution. "Señor Lopez, you have a daughter who is a gem of purest category. You are correct in wanting to see her safely married to a safe man. But she is like me, a child of the revolution that must sweep Mexico. It is proper for her to marry Benito Garza, for he is the new Mexican, the honorable man. They will never have a home like yours, a garden and 6 children. But they will live in the heart of the real Mexico, as I do. Let them marry." When the elder Lopezes refused to accept this advice, Benito and Lucha faced a dilemma. For ancient Spanish custom, now hardened into a law which Mexico honored, held a female to be her father's ward until the age of 25, and without his consent she could not marry. If she did, the marriage could be annulled, or she could be disowned. And when Lucha pleaded for her parents to relent, they cited this law, and their opposition stiffened. But if Padre Jesus was correct in proclaiming Benito a new Mexican, he could have continued that, "I, Jesus, am the new Catholic priest." For when he learned that Lucha's parents were obdurate, He broke the deadlock simply. "Come with me to the rallying field." And here, where irregulars like himself had gathered, a confused rabble of adventurers and patriots prepared to support the formal army when hostilities began, he married this ill-matched pair. The groom, more than twice the age of the bride, and a son of revolution and disarray. The bride, a daughter of middle-class respectability who should have married a rich landowner. Just as the impromptu ceremony concluded, a messenger splashed across the Rio Grande. Norteamericano soldiers, not 10 miles from the river. At this exciting news, the new husband kissed his wife, then rode hard to General Arista's headquarters, where a team of skilled frontier fighters was assembling. "Let me ride with them as scout," Garza pleaded. And the request was granted. For among the troops, regular or irregular, no one was better at operating in the chaparral of the Nueces Strip. "We must be very quiet, very wily," he warned the regular cavalry as they crossed the river. "If, as they say, the Norteamericanos have Rinches as their scouts, they will be watchful." The oncoming Americans, more than 60 in noisy number, did not have Rangers as scouts. But they were led by 2 able captains, one a West Point graduate. However, the captains were not cautious men, for their big horses raised clouds of dust, and their men engaged in careless chatter, which betrayed their advance. Garza, slipping silently ahead of the Mexican force, watched the approach of the Norteamericanos in disbelief. Where do they think they're going? Why don't they have any scouts out ahead? And after a long inspection, good God, they don't have any Rinches, none at all. Unable to believe that the enemy were behaving so unprofessionally, he trailed them for more than half an hour, expecting that at any moment some knowing scout, perhaps even Otto McNabb, would come upon him suddenly from the rear. But in time, he satisfied himself that his first impressions were correct. No scouts, no Rinches. As silently as a rattlesnake slipping through the grass, Garza made his dusty way back to the Mexican cavalry and helped its commander set a trap for the unsuspecting Norteamericanos, who were now less than 2 miles from the river. Placing riders at various points, the Mexican leader kept his formidable lancers, those daring fighters with steel-tipped poles as sharp as needles, in reserve. And in this disposition, his men awaited the bumbling arrival of the enemy. Garza, well forward of the secluded Mexicans, was accompanied by 10 of the best and most daring irregulars, who moved their horses about so that the Norteamericanos must detect them. And when this happened, there was a flurry of shots and much galloping. But Benito and his men knew how to avoid that first fierce charge. With great skill, they rode this way and that, confusing the Norteamericanos and leading them into the well-laid trap. The battle was harsh and brief. Just as the American cavalry was about to overtake Garza, who fled in apparent terror, he flashed a signal, whereupon General Arista's best lancers swung into action, and before the hard-riding dragoons from Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Missouri knew what was happening, they were surrounded and captured, all 63 of them. By lucky accident, 16 of the intruders were killed or badly wounded. By design, one of the wounded was set free to inform General Taylor of the humiliating loss. He was outraged that troops of his could be so inefficient in the field, but pleased that at last the Mexicans had come across the Rio Grande and actually killed American troops. To President Polk, he was able to send the message that those who sought war with Mexico had awaited. "Today, Mexican troops have invaded American soil and killed American troops. Hostilities may now be considered as commenced." The war with Mexico had begun. Taylor's army had 3 weaknesses, and he was now painfully aware of them. His horses, though big and sturdy, were not accustomed to operations in an extreme southern climate like the Strip's. He had few scouts experienced in such terrain. But most important of all, his enlisted men were an untested collection whose officers could only speculate on how they will perform in battle. Therefore, When the state of Texas offered to provide a group of rangers well-versed in chaparral fighting, he faced a dilemma. As a strict disciplinarian, he did not relish accepting a group of unruly Texans into his orderly ranks. But, as a general responsible for the safety of a large army in a strange land, he knew he must have sharp eyes out front, and these he lacked. With great reluctance, and after a painful delay, he grudgingly announced, "We must have reliable scouts. We'll take the Texans." However, West Point men like Lieutenant Colonel Cobb warned of the dangers. "The Texans may be fine horsemen, but the word you just used doesn't apply to them." "What word?" Taylor growled. "Reliable." "They won their independence, didn't they?" "On their peculiar terms." "Damned effective terms they were," old Rough and Ready snapped. "Kill Mexicans." Then he added in gentler tones, "Before we took them into the Union, they had half the nations of Europe inviting them to join their empires, didn't they?" "Granted. But now we're talking about bringing them into the regular army, and frankly, sir, I don't think they'd fit." "Why not? If we swear them in and place reliable officers over them like yourself, Cobb, they'll do fine." "But their clothes, they're a rabble." "Cobb, haven't you noticed? I often go without a military uniform." "Please, sir, don't encourage the Texans. They think they're still a free nation. They're dickering with us on the terms under which they will provide us with men."
"They're what?"
"The state government wants to negotiate." "What in hell do you mean?" Taylor thundered. And Cobb explained. "It says it may be willing to let you have 2 full regiments, but only on its own conditions." He summarized the limiting conditions under which all volunteers joined the regular army, plus a few galling things which Texas had added. Variable terms of enlistment, their own rate of pay. "It's just as if Prussia were offering us units on Prussian terms." "We'll have none of that." "Then you'll have no Texans."
"You mean that at the end of 3 months maybe they could go home?"
"They'd insist upon it. That's the way they've always served." A colonel from Mississippi explained. "They're farmers. They like to get back home to tend the crops. Of course they'll come back to the army when the crops are in, if they feel like it." Cobb added, "Nor do they wish to wear our uniform, or use our horses, or use our rifles. Each Texan feels he knows more about fighting than any man from New York possibly could, and he insists upon doing it his way, dressed in whatever makes him feel comfortable." Taylor grew impatient with the wrangling. "Don't you suppose I know they'll be troublesome?" For some minutes, which he would in months come to remember ruefully, he toyed with the idea of rejecting them as ungovernable. But in the end he growled, "We'll take the 2 regiments." And then he added words which Cobb would also remember with bitterness. "And since you seem to know so much about them, Persifer, you can serve as my liaison." It was under these slippery conditions that 36 Rangers of Captain Garner's Company M joined General Taylor's Army of Regulars, and their arrival caused Persifer Cobb only grief. In these years, the United States Army roster listed many soldiers bearing the unusual first name of Persifor, also spelled Persifer, and what accounted for its sudden popularity, or even its genesis, no one could say. But there was General Persifor Smith and Colonel Persifer Carrick, and a smattering of Major Persifor's this and Captain Persifer's that. Ordinary privates bearing the name have not been recorded. The Persifer Cobb, serving under General Taylor, came from a noble cotton plantation which comprised most of Edisto Island off the coast of South Carolina. He had been a tense, proper young gentleman of 20 when his father announced, "Any self-respecting Southern family ought to have a son in the Army. Persifer, off to West Point." In that austere environment, he had conducted himself honorably, and upon graduation into the regular service, he strove to exemplify in thought and action the best of Southern tradition.
He spoke with an excessive drawl, and defended in both mess and field the highest traditions of Southern chivalry. But now, on the dusty fields of Texas, he was not a happy man. The first source of his discomfort was that irritating adjective which preceded his rank. He was a colonel, one of the most proper in the national force. But he was not yet a full colonel. He was only a lieutenant colonel, rightfully convinced that he merited higher rank. The special nature of his displeasure manifested itself in his first letter home to his younger brother, who was overseeing the Edisto plantation during the colonel's absence. Rio Grande, the 30th of April. Dear Brother Somerset, General Taylor and his troops are encamped at a new fort on the north bank of this river opposite Matamoros, and we would be well prepared to meet the Mexicans had we not been joined recently by a civilian muster out of Texas, and a more disgraceful, unruly, and downright criminal element I have rarely seen. They call themselves Texas Rangers, although I am informed that not more than 10% have previously served in that informal service. They wear no uniform, no badges of distinction, so that we regular army men cannot separate a captain from a private, and discipline they know not. General Taylor has made no secret of the fact that he did not want any Texas volunteers, but Texas, as you know, is now a state, having been an independent republic. And since its citizens, having once been members of a free nation, carry an exalted opinion of their own importance, local politicians forced their native sons upon us. Well, the Texas Rangers are among us, and their presence must give the Mexican generals hope, for a more worthless collection of men one rarely sees. What purely galls us regular army men who have slaved in the colors for years to gain our promotions is that when the Texans come slouching into camp, they, like all volunteers, immediately hold an election, mind you, to choose their company officers. And yesterday, a Texan with never a day at military school rode into our camp, announcing that the state of Texas had appointed him full colonel, and now he brazens his way about camp superior to me. I, a graduate of West Point, with 12 years of arduous service behind me in all military specialties and all geographical areas, must take orders from a man who last week was herding cattle and has never heard of Hannibal or Marshal Ney. I was requested by General Taylor, and of course accepted, to take under my charge the Company M of Rangers who are to serve as my scouts, and it will suffice to describe 3 of them to you. Captain Garner, captain, mind you, who was never lieutenant, just mysteriously captain, is enormously tall, enormously thin, with great flowing mustaches and a leather belt 6 inches wide. He wears whatever comes to hand, including a jacket which once served the Mexican army, for he says he took it from an officer he shot along the Rio Grande. Taciturn, mean-spirited, grimly silent when reproved, he stalks about like an avenging angel, taking orders from no one, and always wanting to lead his men off to some foray under his own direction. In our regular army, he would not last through sunset of the first day. His chosen assistant, a lieutenant perhaps, but without rank, for the Rangers care little about such distinctions, is a slight young man of no more than 20, although he claims 26. I know him only as Otto, but he is unforgettable. Small, not more than 140, wiry, blonde, silent, and with the brightest blue eyes. He never smiles, just looks right through you, and the other men consider him the best ranger of the lot. What makes him stand out more than anything else is that he wears a garment they call in these parts a duster, a very light coat of linen and cotton which reaches from neck to boot top, with only 3 buttons to fasten it en route. Otto's is a pale white in color, and is supposed to keep the dust off during long rides. But when he walks about our camp, the duster makes him look like a little lost ghost, for his small feet seem scarcely to move under it as he steps. On his first day in camp, I told him rather sternly, "We do not wear clothes like that in this camp," and he replied, "I do," and off he waddled, looking so much like a duck that I had no further desire to discipline him. The third ranger is like no one you have ever encountered on Edisto. He calls himself Panther Comax because of the panther pelt hat he wears with the tail hanging over his left ear. And where he comes from, no one can tell me, least of all he. When I asked, he said, "People get finicky if I bust another man over the head with an axe handle and run off with his horse and his wife." He would put the horse first. He mentions Georgia, Massachusetts, and Missouri without actually claiming to have lived in any of them. I think of him mostly as hair, for he has a huge head of it, coal black, which he grows long, tying it matted behind his ears with a deerskin thong. He wears a beard which almost hides his face, has heavy, menacing eyebrows and long black hairs growing out of the backs of his hands. He is over 6 feet tall, heavy-set, and with the meanest look in his eye I have ever seen. It is appropriate that he should call himself Panther, because he really is an animal. He carries an enormously heavy rifle, and a knife with a 12-inch blade. The other rangers tell me he was a member of that ridiculous Mier expedition of 1842, when a rabble of Texans invaded Mexico, thinking they could defeat the entire Mexican army. Outnumbered 10-1, they were tricked into surrendering, and the disaster would have been long forgotten, except that the Mexican general, Santa Anna, about whom I wrote you when we were in camp in Mississippi, ordered one Texas prisoner in every 10 shot, and the decimation was to be determined by drawing beans from a clay pot. White bean, you lived. Black bean, you were shot on the spot. I asked Panther Comax if he had drawn a bean, and he said, "Yep, white." I then asked him if he had served time in Perote Prison, an infamous place somewhere deep in Mexico. And he said, "Yep, killed two guards and escaped." He is a frightening man, capable of anything. And when I asked him why he wanted to go back into Mexico with us, he said, "They is certain individuals down there as I would like to meet again." These are the men, the untrained ruffians who are to be my scouts. I have not the slightest hope of disciplining them or converting them into regular army members. I do not look forward to leading such riffraff into Mexico. But just before starting this letter, I saw my three chosen rangers coming at me from a distance, lanky Captain Garner on the left, big, burly Panther Comax on the right, and little boy Otto in his long, flapping duster in the middle, a head or more shorter than his companions. And as I watched them come at me, I thought, God preserve the officer who attempts to lead these fellows, and God preserve doubly any Mexicans they meet, for I have learned an interesting fact from my orderly. This kid Otto, his father and uncle was killed by Mexicans, his mother and aunt by the Comanche. He's afraid of nothing, just starts coming at you and never stops. I am not happy in Texas, and shall feel greatly relieved when we finally cross into Mexico. Your brother, Persifer.